The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
When I teach my introductory meditation classes, as people start to connect with the mindfulness practice and begin to understand how their minds work a little bit and see that a lot of what causes our suffering has to do with the way our mind works. One of the questions that people ask is, why does it do this? Why does it do this to us? This is a question that's not new to our time. During the time of the Buddha, a similar kind of question came up. So in one discourse, during a conversation with the Buddha, someone asked a question. Why, when we wish to be happy and peaceful, do we not live that way? This is essentially the same question. Why is it that with this wish to be happy, we do things that actually are the opposite, things that make us unhappy? And the Buddha's response to this question, in a very clear way and a very classic way for the Buddha, laid out why this happens to us in a kind of a cause and condition, effect follows effect way. So he said that we live in conflict, and conflict arises due to jealousy and avarice. Jealousy and avarice arise due to liking and disliking. Liking and disliking arise due to desire or craving. And craving arises due to thinking. And thinking arises due to a tendency to proliferate. And this term, this saying, this tendency to proliferate, the proliferation part, the Pali for that word is papancha. And there's not a very good translation for this term. It's been translated in a number of ways. Some people have translated it as a tendency to proliferation, an explosion of thought, complication, self-reflexive thinking, exaggeration, elaboration, and distortion. These are different words that kind of capture some of the meaning of papancha. So the Buddha, basically in this discourse, traces conflict back to this tendency of the mind to elaborate and complicate. And this is what I'd like to spend some time talking about tonight, this papancha. So it's not very well described in terms of a translation. It's a complicated word to translate. But as I begin to talk about it, I think you will recognize it. It's not a very obscure experience. It's one that we have all the time. So as I begin to talk about it, I think you'll begin to know what I'm talking about. So there's different ways in which the Buddha approached this topic. And one was through a poem that he gave. It was a kind of a little concise teaching, this poem. And as I was doing the putting this talk together, I discovered I wanted to use this poem, as I knew I wanted to use this poem, and I went to look it up in the suttas. And I discovered something that I didn't know about this poem, and that is that it appears in four different suttas of the middle-length discourses, which is one of the main discourses of the Buddha. And the four different discourses are kind of all variations on a theme. They basically, at least three of them, are variations where there's two people talking and they say, "Do you remember that poem the Buddha taught about a single excellent night?" And the other person says, "No, I don't remember it. Why don't we go find out about it and ask somebody to explain it to us?" And this is repeated 3 times. Do you remember this? No. Well, let's find out about it. It gives me the idea that this was an important poem because it is repeated. So one right after the other, 4 suttas in the middle-length discourses. So I'll read you the poem, and then I'll talk a little bit about it because it is a concise teaching. And in these suttas, basically, people hear this poem and then they go, please explain that to us. We don't really understand what it means. So I'll read it, and then I'll elaborate a little bit. Let not a person revive the past or on the future build his hopes, for the past has been left behind and the future has not been reached. Instead, with insight, let her see each presently arisen state. Let her know that and be sure of it, invincibly, unshakably. Today the effort must be made. Tomorrow death may come, who knows? No bargain with mortality can keep him and his hordes away. But one who dwells thus ardently, relentlessly by day, by night, it is he, the peaceful sage has said, who has had a single excellent night. So I'll go through this, at least the first part of this poem, line by line. So the first line is, let not a person revive the past. So what does that mean, reviving the past? Basically, this is the way our minds create the experience of the past in the present moment. So, for example, I'll give you an example from my own experience. At one point in my life, I did a little bit of acting. And at one point I was in a play, and one night during the performance, I forgot my lines. And I tried ad-libbing for a while so that the other people on the stage would know that I had forgotten my lines, and hopefully that they'd jump in and save me. But after 4 or 5 different ad-libbings, nobody came up with anything, and I came out of things to ad-lib. And so I just stood there and stared out at the audience. It was really embarrassing. That was the past. That was that experience. Then on one retreat, I noticed a memory appearing in my mind of standing on that stage and looking out at the audience. And I noticed that the feeling of embarrassment came up all over again. You know, the thoughts about it. How could I have fixed this? How could I have done better? Could I have ad-libbed more? Could I have just jumped over that line and gone on to the next one? And the feeling of embarrassment was revived, essentially. This is reviving the past. There's a memory or a thought that appears in the mind, and then we start thinking about it, and we begin to experience the emotions that happened during that experience. So that's reviving the past. The thought itself doesn't have to actually trigger all of that emotional response. As I discovered on this retreat, after some time of seeing this thought, feeling the embarrassment over and over again, I finally began to recognize that that thought came up as a separate thing in my experience, and that the embarrassment didn't have to follow if I just noticed that thought as a thought arising. So that's where we don't have to revive the past. There can be a thought that appears in our minds about the past, and we don't have to jump on that thought and think more thoughts about it. That's that tendency to proliferation, that tendency to explode in thought around something. So that's that reviving the past. The next part of the poem is, let not a person revive the past or on the future build her hopes. And as I look at this in my own experience, I see that it really is building hopes and fears on the future. I see both happening in my own experience. And again, this what happens to us is that there's a thought that appears in the mind about the future. Perhaps some planning of some kind comes up, some idea of something we need to do. And then we start thinking about it, proliferating about it, planning about it, and counting on it perhaps to happen. Really building our hopes upon that, making it a solid thing. This has to happen. That's what will make me happy. Or other ways we can build our fears or perhaps our anger on the future. This is what I was pretty expert at doing this. I still see this happening, but before I started meditating, this my mind just did all the time. It would think a thought. I was in this particular relationship, and there was some rockiness in this relationship. And I would think a thought about my boyfriend and then think that he might do something that would hurt me. And then I would get angry about it. It was as if I had created this belief that, well, even if it wasn't actually, it hadn't actually happened yet, well, it was possible that it could happen. And I was angry about that. So that is building the future. Again, it's doing it with our thoughts. So there's the thought that appears in the mind, and then there's this elaboration that happens. This is the papancha. This is this elaboration that happens on our thoughts. So again, we can simply have these thoughts come up in our minds and not necessarily elaborate on them. But there's a very strong underlying tendency towards this elaboration. It's a very strong habit in our minds to proliferate in this way. So it's a hard one to break into. But the teachings do provide some suggestions. So I'm hoping that as we go through this tonight, that you'll get some ideas about how to actually work with this and to break into this pattern, this underlying tendency towards this proliferation. So the interesting thing about the past and the future is that when we're in that state of reviving the past or building our hopes or fears on the future, we believe somehow that that is a real thing. You know, there's a way in which we actually, there's a reification, an identification that happens, and we're in that place and that time, and we actually believe it to be what happened or what will happen. So there's a way in which our minds create the past and the future. Another example of this from my own experience. Now, I find often with this reviving the past and building hopes and fears on the future, there's an emotional connection or an emotional component to that reviving, an emotional component to that papancha. It seems often that the emotions drive that proliferation. But it's not actually even necessary that the emotions drive it. It can just be an explosion of thought that happens in our minds. So another example of this, which let me understand how this can happen without emotion, is that there was this relationship that was troublesome for me for many years. At some point I was working with the anger over it, and I really worked through a lot of anger over that relationship. And at some point, all the anger really dissipated. And there was a thought of this relationship, of the person, of things we'd done, could appear in my mind. And I wouldn't get angry about it. I wouldn't get frustrated or feel like I'd been betrayed. It would just be the thought in my mind. But I began noticing that there would be times when these thoughts would appear and the mind would go into this world, this bubble of remembering an event that happened, something we had done together. And it created that world so completely that when I recognized that I was thinking about it and came out of that world, that was very confusing, because it felt in that experience like I was back in that relationship with him. So the mind had created this thought world in which I was living and believed that I was back in that place and time. And the way I could see this so clearly was because there was no longer any emotional reactivity. So when that bubble popped, it just popped and left me with this kind of weird feeling of state of like, where was I? I was just back in that relationship. And it's been years since I've been in that relationship. So it doesn't even have to involve emotion. It can just be the mind creating a world, either in the past or in the future. It's like a bubble that we live in for a few minutes or even hours. But what's so interesting about this is that as we start to pay attention to our experience, we begin to notice that the past, what is the past actually? What is our experience of the past? It's actually a thought that arises in the present moment. And what's our experience of the future? Again, it's a thought that arises in the present moment. All that we have in our existence is this moment. That is it. We're living on this like needle, this needle point. And that's all we have in any particular moment. Sometimes when we begin to come into the present moment and we feel like, you know, okay, let go of the past, let go of the future, it's like, well it feels like things get really narrow. You know, it's like, what is this about anyway, just being right here in this tip of this present moment? And someone talked to Ajahn Amaro about this. He's a monk that lives up in Northern California. And his response to this was, well, as you begin to actually explore the present moment and you see that what all the past is a thought that's arising in the present moment, and what the future is a thought that's arising in the present moment, it's not that the present moment gets so narrow. It's actually that the present moment gets really big, because it encompasses everything. It encompasses past, it encompasses future, it encompasses now, because everything that we experience is happening here and now. So it doesn't have to feel like this really restrictive place. So our thoughts are of the past, of the future, are simply things that are arising right here and right now. And this is part of the key to working with papancha. So the next part of this poem, well, I'll read this first part again. Let not a person revive the past or on the future build his hopes, for the past has been left behind and the future has not been reached. Instead, with insight, let her see each presently arisen state. Let her know that and be sure of it, invincibly, unshakably. So in the elaboration of this line in the discourse, it first talks not about how we approach the present moment with insight. It talks about how we mistakenly are, quote, vanquished by the present moment. That's the word the sutta uses. How are we vanquished by the present moment? this vanquishing actually happens through the papancha. It happens through the mental proliferation, through this explosion of thought. And we can become hooked into our thoughts and experience anxiety, desire, fear, frustration, all because of this momentum of papancha. There's another text that gives a very clear description of how this mental proliferation begins. The last description I gave was what happens as a result of this mental proliferation. As a result of the mental proliferation, there's thinking. Craving follows thinking. Liking and disliking follows craving. Of avarice and jealousy follows that, and conflict follows that. So we talked about what's the result of this proliferation. But in this text, he actually talks, how does it begin? Where does it get created? So there's two parts to this. And I'll read this first part and then give some examples about it. So again, this description that the Buddha gives, it's very classic description of cause and effect. And he goes through each sense door. So this first one is about how this arises based on seeing something. And then he goes through how it arises based on hearing something, smelling something, tasting something, touching something, and thinking about something. All of the different ways in which we take in sense experience. But I'll just read this first one about seeing. So dependent on the eye and forms, eye consciousness arises. So that's really just a very simple description of the process of seeing, which is dependent on the physical eye and stuff in the world, there is this seeing that happens. And he says that the meeting of those three, the meeting of the eye and the object and this consciousness or the seeing, the actual seeing, that is called contact. There's the contact of all of those three things. With contact as a condition, there is feeling. The thing experienced, the thing seen, is either pleasant, it's unpleasant, or it's neutral, neither pleasant or unpleasant. So when we see something, when we hear something, smell something, taste something, one of the first things that happens to us is that we recognize it's pleasant or unpleasant, or it's neutral. What one feels, that one perceives. Perception is this act of recognizing what it is that we are seeing. So blue, square, beige. And then there's the next level of actually recognizing carpet, chair, wall, person. And then perhaps even the next level of recognizing man, woman, somebody you know. All of those are perceptions. So what one feels, that one perceives. What one perceives, that one thinks about. This should be very familiar to you. What you see in the world, we think about it. This happens to us all throughout the day. What often happens to us is that we see something, there's a moment of recognizing, oh, there's that person that I know, or there's a Prius, or there's a tree, or there's a bird. And then if something about that thing kind of strikes us, like a Prius, it's like, oh, a Prius. Wow, that would be a nice car. Saves gas. We start thinking about it. The next step is what one thinks about, that one mentally proliferates. So this is where the papancha comes in. So an example to kind of carry through all of these steps, very simple example from our experience. You're sitting here in meditation and you experience some physical experience, a physical bodily experience. And you notice it as it's probably, you know, it's an unpleasant experience. And you perceive it as an itch. So you're sitting in meditation, there's this recognition of the feeling of unpleasant and the perception of something as an itch. And then we often start to think about it. Where did this itch come from? How do I have this itch? Maybe it's a mosquito bite. You know, so you've got some thoughts about the itch. Now, this is not yet the proliferation. This is kind of a simple level of thought about the itch. But then perhaps the thinking takes on a new quality. What if that mosquito had West Nile virus? What if I get really sick and I have to stop working and my house goes into foreclosure? This is papancha. That is that proliferation that we've left behind the simple thoughts and we've begun to elaborate and to complicate. This happens to us all the time. This is a very common way in which we live our lives. There's these moments we have of actually contacting our direct experience. We couldn't live our lives without directly contacting our direct experience. But what happens from that moment of contacting our direct experience is that we leap into thought about it and into this mental proliferation. And there we are, off in some world or other of driving a Prius to down the coast of California or whatever else we create in our minds. So that's the way in which this papancha begins. But this sutta doesn't actually stop there. And it goes into an interesting loop here. This next sentence reads in a complicated way, but I'll read it to you and then I'll describe it because it's actually a really crucial piece of why this papancha hooks us so strongly. With what one has mentally proliferated as the source, perceptions and notions tinged by mental proliferation beset a man with respect to past, future, and present forms cognizable through the eye. Now again, he's just going through the eye door here, but he goes through all of the sense doors. So, with what one has mentally proliferated as the source, perceptions and notions tinged by mental proliferation beset a man with respect to past, present, and future. Now, what does that mean? What I understand this to mean is that basically when we move into that cloud of papancha, that cloud of mental proliferation, it actually impacts the way that we perceive our world. Now, I'll give you another example of this. It's as if that cloud of papancha essentially becomes the filter through which we see our experience. And we select certain things out of our experience, respond to certain things in a way through that filter. Essentially reinforcing the filter. So I'll give you another example of this. Suppose you see somebody walking across the street. And normally that might be just kind of a neutral thing, just seeing somebody, seeing a stranger. But suppose this person has a body type like somebody who has harmed you in the past, or perhaps somebody who's abused you. So the perception of that person may not be neutral anymore. There may be this filter of fear, essentially, because of the connection of the body type. So essentially we have brought the perceptual process is going through this world of a lot of our past, of our past conditioning, our past history. This happens to us a lot also. There's a description, one scholar who studied this phenomenon says about this. He describes first the process of this papancha, or this distorted perception that I'm talking about. He describes this distorted perception, this essentially filtering our experience comes in through this filter of this papancha. He says, this distorted perception is placing every bare perception into a framework of emotions and beliefs that have come out of our past, our history, and our conditioning. Because every experience kind of gets put onto this framework of our history, which has been created through our conditioning. And he goes on to say, this distorted perception robs the freshness out of our experience. But we are not aware of this constant interference of the past. Because of this unawareness, which is our ignorance or our delusion, we see humanity fragmented as me and others, us and them, and in various other stereotypes, skin color, ethnicity, language, ideology included. So it's this process works on a societal level as well, creating racism, sexism, ageism, homophobia, all kinds of different kinds of discriminations because of this filter of experience. Now, I'm not saying that we should not take care in observing our environment. There are times when we're walking through a dangerous environment and we need to be very attuned to our environment. But I'd like to suggest that actually this filter may get in the way of really being clearly perceiving what is happening, what is actually happening. So this process works on a societal level, creating divisions, discriminations between us and between ourselves and other people. It creates this conflict. This is this beginning of this conflict. And it also creates a kind of division in ourselves, a conflict in ourselves, an internal kind of conflict. So often the way this has been described by this professor, it's very much history coming in and filtering our perceptions. That our past comes in and we live our lives essentially through a filter of our past. But there's also a way in which we can, in the moment, without even necessarily having a history, distort our perceptions based on what we think about something. And I'll give you another example of this. This is another experience I had on retreat. I was in Burma on a long retreat at a monastery. And in the monastery, it was in a rural area, but it was surrounded on all sides by a rural village. And, you know, a lot of the sounds of the village kind of came in over the walls of the monastery, and my dorm was right next to this wall. So I heard a lot of village sounds. You know, sometimes there were loudspeakers with Burmese opera going, or rock and roll music going, or there was just the sound of the children or somebody playing some kind of a game, or all kinds of different sounds came in. And during the evenings, I began to often notice I would hear a squealing sound. It sounded to me like pigs squealing. And it happened so regularly, and there was such a kind of a distressing tone to the squeal that I thought that there must be pigs being slaughtered on the other side for the next day's meals. And this created a kind of a feeling of compassion in my experience, a feeling of a little bit of distress for these pigs that were being killed. And so it was happening pretty regularly. And then one night I was out for a walk around dusk, and I saw all these bats flying around. And I noticed that they made that squealing sound. And it was the bats making that sound, not pigs being slaughtered. So in that moment, I saw how my, essentially, papancha around this idea of the pigs had distorted my perception. So this kind of thing happens to us all the time. So how do we work with this? Partly, we're not going to just be able to stop it. Right, in, you know, it's like it is so ingrained in us, this process of proliferation, that we are going to keep doing it. But if you notice that you're in the midst of this process of proliferation, can you notice that as something that's happening now in the present moment? Something that the mind is doing right now in the present moment. So that instead of becoming the past or future, instead of becoming this thing that you're living in, it simply becomes something that's happening right here and right now. This is what it means in the poem when it says, instead, with insight, let her see each presently arisen state. So this is our moment-to-moment practice, our moment-to-moment looking at our experience, noticing what's actually happening, and that everything that we're experiencing is just something happening in the present moment. Something that's happening in our minds, something that's happening as a result of contact with our physical experience. Can we notice this is something happening right here and right now? If it's fear, can we just notice the fear? Can we just be with the fear? If it's excitement, can we notice excitement and just be with excitement? So this is our moment-to-moment practice, noticing when we remember, when we wake up into the midst of an elaborate papancha, can we remember it is simply something, a process going on in the mind? There is a beautiful teaching that describes the mind without papancha. It's from a fairly famous teaching. A man named Bahiya comes to the Buddha and asks him to teach him the Dharma in brief. So teach him the teachings in brief. And the Buddha does this, and there's two parts to this, so I'll read each part. Bahiya, you should train yourself thus. In reference to the seen, there will be only the seen. In reference to the heard, only the heard. In reference to the sensed, only the sensed. In reference to the cognized, only the cognized. That is how you should train yourself. So what he's essentially recommending is connecting with our bare experience, actually noticing as closely as we can what are we actually seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, perceiving, sensing. Initially, that perception will be through this filter of papancha, but can we notice what we are actually experiencing in the present moment? And he goes on, when for you there will be only the seen in reference to the seen, only the heard in reference to the heard, only the sensed in reference to the sensed, only the cognized in reference to the cognized. So essentially, when you are at this place where you can really contact your direct experience, he says, then, Bahiya, there is no you in terms of that. When there is no you in terms of that, there is no you there. When there is no you there, you are neither here nor yonder nor between the two. This, just this, is the end of suffering. So this sounds a little odd, perhaps. This is pointing to this recognition that this idea of self is actually, it's a construct of our minds. And the Buddha isn't in this teaching actually saying you have to believe this, that this construct of self, that this thing of self, this experience of self is a construct of our minds. It's so hard to believe that because it is such a deep and abiding experience that we have a self. So simply trying to believe we don't have a self is not usually the way to go. But actually what this self is, it's basically a process that is created through this mental proliferation. And it is in fact the greatest distortion of our perception that we believe that we are an actual separate self, that they're the separate thing of us. But the Buddha here doesn't ask you to believe it. He basically says, contact your direct experience and notice. What do you notice about this process? Or what do you notice about the self when you actually connect to your direct experience? He suggests that when you actually land really directly in your experience, you will not experience this feeling of being separate as a self. It sounds really ungrounding. In many ways, this idea of self is the way in which we relate to our whole world. And it's the whole way in which we move through life, this notion of a self. So it sounds like something that feels like disorienting to think about not having it there. And it is disoriented to think about not having it there from the perspective of the self. But again, if you just simply contact your direct experience and that construction falls away, the experience of that is not one of disorientation or fear. It's actually one of relief. It feels like a huge burden has been set down when that process comes to an end, that process of self comes to an end. And I find it very interesting because so often in looking at some of the teachings, the insight teachings of the Buddha, there's the insight of impermanence, which a lot of people can understand. It's like impermanence, yeah, that I see that. Everything's impermanent, you know, that I can kind of connect with that. I mean, we see things change moment to moment. So that's not such a scary one for us in some ways, because it's something that we can connect with in our day-to-day experience. But this idea of there not being a self, that seems to be, that rattles us. It kind of freaks us out. But the interesting thing I found in my own experience of these two, the more and more I deeply connect with these experiences, the experience, the deep experience of impermanence, the moment-to-moment seeing of things just disappearing rapidly in our experience, that is a frightening experience. That's a very uncomfortable, difficult place to be in. The moment when that process of self falls away, it is a huge relief. So it's interesting to me that the experience, the deeper meditative experience of those two insights is exactly opposite of what our minds think. We're not so afraid of impermanence, but boy, that letting go of the idea of self. But again, we don't have to let it go. You don't have to believe me. All that I suggest that you do is just see if you can contact your direct experience. Notice when there is this papancha. Notice when there is this proliferation that's getting in the way of actually contacting experience. And see what happens. There's no need to believe anything about self or not self. Really, just be with your experience. So as we observe this tendency to proliferate, this tendency of elaboration of complication. It slowly, slowly begins to lose its grip on us. It's like, you know, filters or tethers falling away. And it becomes less of a, it holds less sway over us. And this contacting our direct experience, moment to moment, is the seed. It's the beginning of movement towards freedom and away from the suffering, the complications that we make in our lives. So we've got a few minutes now. If there's any thoughts or questions or comments, anything, yeah. Wait for the mic.
I've been meditating for quite a long time, and I think I'm contacting direct experience, but I wonder what you mean by that, and if you could give an example how you know you're contacting it.
Well, I mean, there's so many levels of that contact. And as I said, initially that contact with direct experience will kind of come through this cloud or this filter of papancha. But there's a way in which we actually know what's happening in the present moment. And that knowing, I mean, the knowing gets sustained. When that knowing gets sustained is when we can begin to really feel how the tentacles of the thought and the processes of our mind begin to release. So that sustaining of that moment-to-moment awareness. We can contact our experience for a brief time, and then we go back into thought, and then we contact again and go back into thought. So there's kind of this alternation of going in and out of thought. But as we can sustain that contact, often it has a sense of, it's not always pleasant, but because, you know, if you're just directly contacting your actual experience, it may be, you know, there may be unpleasantness in your experience. There may be pleasantness in your experience. But there's a way in which it feels like the mind is independent of what you're experiencing. So that there's a sense almost of joy or peace or calm that is surrounding whatever it is, whether it's pleasant, unpleasant. So there's this kind of like neutral space that feels really peaceful around whatever is happening. Maureen.
I was reminded of a poem that I learned when I was a child as you were talking about the burden, losing the burden of self. That's an Emily Dickinson poem. It says, "I'm nobody, who are you? Are you nobody too? How dreary to be somebody, how public like a frog, to tell your name the livelong day to an admiring bog."
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm concerned.
You have to
about,
talk like a.
Yes, okay. I'm concerned about differences or levels of identification, let's say, just to. To begin with, is, for instance, take the word awareness, and who is experiencing, or what is experiencing, this state of awareness,
mm-hmm.
And is awareness equivalent to a universal essence of being? Or state of being, and how is that state of being separate or different from self, and how is self different or separate from ego. I almost equate the existence of self with the state of awareness and of being, but at the same time, ego is an attachment, perhaps that comes along the way during our development. The moment someone attaches a name to us is the identification of ego the same as the level of awareness or state of awareness that exists before the name is given and a series
so, of... So these are a lot of very... they're very deep, profound questions, but thinking about them is not the way to explore them. So, for instance, the initial question, one of the initial questions you asked was, see if I can remember it, what is awareness and who or what experiences that awareness? Thinking about that question is just going to get you caught in an endless loop. See if you can look in your experience. What's awareness? And can you find what it is that is aware of that? Can you actually, and when you, can you actually land in an experience of being aware of awareness? And is there anybody there when you land in that experience? Who is doing that? So to explore those questions, see if you can let go of the kind of thoughts, because you end up, it's essentially a form of papancha to end up in that cycle of thinking about. Take one of those questions and look in your own experience. What is the ego? What do I call the ego? In my own exploration of this, I found that what I call myself seems to be these very familiar patterns of contraction. And it's not always the same patterns, but they're familiar. I've recognized that one. I recognize the miserable Andrea. I recognize this Andrea, you know, so that there's, it's not always the same, but there are these just familiar patterns that kind of come together. So looking in your own experience, what is the ego? What is the experience for any one of those questions? And just a short one, because we yes. It's 9 o'clock now. So.
Yes, okay. Is there something more essential behind Andrea? Something separate from universal.
It's. I look at it more as a process. Andrea is a process. It's not that Andrea doesn't exist, but Andrea is more like a river or a stream of changing causes and conditions. And there's not a Andrea there. It's just a flow of changing experience. And, you know, if you look at what particle physics is coming up with these days, everything in the world, even this podium, is just a flow of particles. And it's not really a solid thing. It's just a particular configuration that interacts with this hand in a particular way. So, again, come back to your own direct experience with any one of those questions. But if you find yourself caught in a thought around them, see if you can just pick one and say, well, let me explore it in my experience. What am I calling me? Who am I? What is awareness? Who is aware? Use it as a exploration of your direct experience, as a pointer to the experience. And you'll probably find some very interesting things. So we need to stop now. So thank you all for your attention, and I hope that you may see your papancha and see it as something happening here and now. Thank you.